Wasn't that prostitute case yours? All right, Roger, would you move on? Roger?
On page two, on section four, the forfeiture section, we added the underlined language specifying that eavesdropping devices that are forfeited to the state shall be by court order turned over to the superintendent of state police for whatever disposition he may
owe. Oh, yeah.
Under section seven, defenses, we've added language under the defense is a person charged with a public servant or a person acting under his direction.
Great.
On page three, section eight, tampering with private communication, you've added a new subsection, subsection two. Problem that arose is in connection with paragraph C, that an employer, an officer of a telephone company, for example, is prohibited from divulging any information that he obtained in the line of work. And he's pointed out that information obtained perhaps in monitoring might disclose a criminal act, criminal conspiracy. So subsection 2, in those cases, would allow disclosure.
Roger, what about the word or to cooperate fully? That kind of scares me. Couldn't they just have the telephone company guys do all the dirty work?
Well, under the article, if the police wanted further information that they desired to obtain through surreptitious news documents, they would have to obtain a warrant.
Okay.
Cooperate fully would mean that they would perhaps be given the opportunity to use the facilities to tap, but they still couldn't do it in the absence of a warrant.
But he couldn't just listen and then report it?
Not under this article, no. Yeah. He would be in violation of eavesdropping.
Well, but he's in violation of eavesdropping to begin with if he reports any information. What information does it contemplate that he reports? How do you know criminal business is going on over the line unless you've had any?
That's what it's intended to be.
Okay. Incidental accidental interception as opposed to purpose.
Well, where is that? That'll be in the commentary.
We don't mean by the term or to cooperate fully that they're going to be allowed on the premises to monitor telephone conversations in the absence of a warrant.
Well, I know, but could not this be if he has a positive duty to cooperate fully, and I'm the officer, and I'll say, now I can't go on into the home office to listen to it, but you just sit there and intercept the calls and listen to them, and then report to me what they said. You don't think that's a problem?
No.
The way the situation is now, if a telephone operator all of a sudden should come upon information that there was a kidnapping or a murder taking place, they would be committing a crime by reporting it.
I'm with you.
Which is absurd.
I see your point, but I just wonder if we not go too far.
I think maybe we're making agents of the police out of these people by this thing.
Cooperate fully. Do we really need that? Isn't that requiring? All the way down to that point is kind of a cop out for the employee. But right from that point on,
how do you enforce that or to cooperate fully? I'm the employee and I cooperate fully. And you're the superior.
What does it add from there on?
You say no.
Really?
Well, I think the protection to the telephone employee if under the police direction they do something that might render them liable to prosecution, you might say. But if they do it under the police direction, they are protected themselves, whether the evidence is being legally obtained so that it could be used or something, but if they do it under the police direction, they would be protected from prosecution.
says is it shall not be unlawful for such employee, having knowledge, to cooperate fully.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's not saying that what's found is going to be legal or anything else. Mm-hmm.
Of course, you could probably delete that last clause, couldn't you?
I think you could delete it, because once they furnished all the information they have available, any action taken by the police after that is either going to be lawful or unlawful.
What we're talking about is the revealing of the information.
Yeah, that's, yeah, I agree with that, but I just wonder if it's become a positive duty for the telephone employee then to be the fink for the local cop.
It'll just won't be unlawful for them. Do I hear a motion?
Mr. Chairman, I would move that we strike all language after the word matter and a period be placed after the word matter.
Excuse me.
I would second that.
Any discussion?
Question.
All those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed, no. Motion is carried. Okay, Roger, don't stop now.
Well, beginning on page 4, and throughout the remainder of this article, this is all new material. And this is the procedure that has to be followed to obtain an eavesdropping warrant. This is based upon the requirements of the federal law of the Ominous Crime Bill. And the model used for it is basically the New York eavesdropping warrant procedure, which was signed into law in June of 1969. I don't know if you want me to read this word for word. There are very few areas in here that, other than structure and language, that are really arguable, because by in effect preempting the field of the Ominous Crime Bill, they've laid out what requirements the states have to follow if you're going to have a valid warrant procedure for eavesdropping, and this follows it in many cases almost word for word.
Let me ask you, Major. Did they in turn preempt the field?
They preempted the field to the extent that they have said that if states want to enact a eavesdropping procedure, they're going to have to do it this way, and then they lay out the way it's going to have to be done. And they go as far as even designating the crimes for which the warrants can be obtained.
But we don't have to follow those crimes.
We can, we don't have to follow them. You can't go beyond them. In other words, we couldn't provide that you can get an eavesdropping warrant in all misdemeanor cases, because they don't allow it.
Vice Chairman, why do we include district court judges on the authority here? Why not just circuit judges? I like to give the circuit judges what to do. Is there any reason to include?
I think the does the omnibus bill speak to which state judges can issue a warrant? I think it does.
Judge of competent jurisdiction under the federal law means a judge of any court of general criminal jurisdiction of a state.
A competent judge.
I was going to say, what word does that modify?
A court of competent jurisdiction. I don't know of any such courts.
I think
a judge of any court of general criminal jurisdiction.
Well, then that would exclude district court.
Yeah, it would. Yeah.
It
has to be circuit court.
Mr. Max representative.
We can delete the words district court judge.
Yes. Yes. Representative Frost.
Mr. Young and I are having problems with typos again. On page 4, sub 3, is the word altering?
No, that's
working, maybe.
That's altering.
Altering
should be
alerting.
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 It will make
sub 3, line 3.
Alerting. Would you make a note of that, Mrs. Carpenter, and make the appropriate change?
What is it?
Well,
letters the second time.
I didn't bring with me a copy of the omnibus bill.
Well, in your books, now we have U.S. Code, the chapter that applies, chapter 119, is under the second white tab in your books.
Chairman?
Yes.
Should it be county, of the county, or should it be of the district? We're going to deal with the circuit court judges.
Yeah.
Where are you reading that?
I'm in sub 6. Judge means a circuit court judge of the county. Shouldn't be of the, yeah, of the state. Maybe, or of the circuit district, or...
I'm not sure about that.
Well...
Take, for example, a district where... Isn't Stuart Weiss in the same district with Tompkins?
Yeah.
Well, I wouldn't think, for example, that you would be going to Tompkins for a warrant in Newport.
Talking about the venue.
Well, not the venue, but in other words, the if it's, say it's in Bob Cannell's area, there isn't any problem in saying district. But where you have districts in which you really are got a judge from one county and a judge from another, I think that could be perhaps a sticky wickets kind of a situation.
It would have to be that way. We've gone for search warrants now. If Judge Mingler and Judge Gilland are both out of town, we quite often go over to Albany and Judge Johns or Judge Tompkins.
I think it has to be statewide. The judge has jurisdiction statewide.
It had to be somebody who had jurisdiction in that county. And of course, in those multiple judges, multiple county districts, they all have jurisdiction.
John, the circuit court does have jurisdiction statewide anyway.
But it would have to be a judge who had jurisdiction.
I think it's dangerous to limit it to either the county or the district, because we have judges that float around.
That's right.
For instance, Judge Hicks, who now takes over at Roseburg, where they have one judge sometimes. And that means if no warrants, if we were restricted to county, because there's nobody in the district can do warrants to.
We often have Judge Rolfe sitting in Multnomah County.
Not too often, do
you? Not anymore.
We haven't asked for
it. Nothing but a down view.
I can see a certain amount of problem if we have, say, an investigation going on in Benton County, and so we go running down to Medford and get a circuit judge down there to issue the warrant for...
Isn't that being taken care of, though?
But that...
prosecutorial discretion.
Yeah. Really, though, a circuit court judge in Medford is going to be highly suspicious if you come running down there to do that. He's going to have some awfully valid reasons why you're using him.
Mm-hmm. Well, why couldn't you just say judge means a circuit court judge? Mm-hmm. And it's the same way, like we go over to a search warrant over there, and they want to know where Manfred is.
Why you call me at 3 in the morning?
Mr. Chairman, I move we amend 6 to read judge means a circuit court judge and the remainder of the language being amended.
I second. You've heard the motion. Is there any further discussion? If not, everybody in favor of the amendment say aye.
Aye.
No. And it's carried.
I'm back down in sub B of section 3 on page 4, and it raises the same problem I had back on page 1 of the amendment, and that is that we designate in section 1 on page 1 of the amendment shall not be unlawful for a peace officer or a person acting in his direction to overhear in the court. We don't have any qualifying comments as to an officer acting in his official capacity. And it is quite common for you hire an off-duty policeman for investigative work in a civil case, in this case, this type of
person. Where's that?
I've lost you.
Where's that? No, it is that.
Well, that's an unethical act for a police officer.
Well, small cities and constables and, you know. But I think what we're talking about is a peace officer acting in a special capacity.
Sure.
And are we opening a hole here?
Can we not take care of that in the commentary?
I'm sorry, I've lost you, Dave.
Well, look back in section 2, first page of the amendment.
Yes.
Down in subsection 1, we say, except that it shall not be unlawful for a peace officer or a person acting under the direction to overhear or record a conversation by means of a talking device, so on and so forth.
All right.
What I'm worried about is we're talking strictly about investigation of crimes and not civil offenses, and not a peace officer working for a lawyer or some other person on a civil case.
Well, it says not be unlawful for a peace officer or a person acting under his direction.
Well, a peace officer is a peace officer 24 hours a day, whether he's on duty or not.
Well, of course, when you've got this under this section 9 getting the eavesdropping warrant, of course, they only can be issued when you're investigating certain crimes. So it would have to be
Well, and no, this is the exception. This is a definition of the crime of eavesdropping, as I understand section 2. Then we put an exception to that crime with a peace officer. But we don't refer back to having obtained an eavesdropping warrant or of him acting as a official pastor or anything. We say, if you're a peace officer, you're clean.
Mr. Chairman, I don't think that hurts anything to add that language. It doesn't detract from any of the powers that we mean to give him.
Maybe the commentary approach would take care of it, but it's easy to put an acting as a
I don't know.
Mr. Chairman, I move that we amend 2 sub 1 and 9 sub 4 sub B to insert the words acting in his official capacity in each of those sections following the words peace officer.
Shall not be unlawful for a peace officer acting in his official capacity or a person acting under his direction. Is that correct? Okay, you've heard the amendment. And now, before we... Well, all right, you've heard the amendment. Is there further discussion? All right, if not, all in favor of the amendment in the two places, say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed, no. Okay, Gary. Now, can I... I want to ask a question before I relinquish my...
No, go ahead.
Glory. Roger, why in 2 sub 1 do you say unlawful for a peace officer or a person acting under his direction, where in 9 4b you say recorded by a peace officer or a person acting under his direct supervision or command?
The reason is because starting with section 9 we were using a different model. Actually, they probably should conform, and paragraph B of subsection 4 particularly well would leave your person acting in his direction. It says the same.
With that in mind, then, Mr. Chairman, I'd move that we again amend 9 4B to make...
Well, do we want to amend 9 4B because here we're following the federal language?
Amend the first one to conform with the second.
All right. Amend 2-1 to conform with language in 9 4B. So, okay.
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried.
Now, subsection 8 on designated offense is incomplete. I felt we couldn't analyze all the offenses that would be covered until we had got the entire subject code together.
Yeah, that's right. It might be a good idea to take a look at chapter 119 of title 18.
Section 2516.
What page is it on?
Yeah. Page 277.
Page 277.
Okay. We can enforce the Atomic Energy Act.
Subsection 2, the section 278.
Where you want to look is on page 278, sub
sub 2, where it talks about the principal prosecuting attorney of any state, that's where they list out the kinds of offenses that would qualify. Now, Mr. Chairman, I might point out, when we first discussed this in subcommittee, we first took a look at this, I think we were under the impression that you were going to be limited to felonies, but I think a closer reading of this sub 2 indicates that certain specific offenses would qualify for wiretap, even though they aren't felonies. And because the language says, when such interception may provide or has provided evidence of the commission of the offense of murder, kidnapping, gambling, robbery, bribery, extortion, or dealing in narcotic drugs, marijuana, or other dangerous drugs, or other crime dangerous to life, limb, or property, and is punishable by imprisonment for more than 1 year.
Punishable means, for more than 1 year, means crimes dangerous to life, limb, or property.
Right.
And not the.
I don't think it qualifies all of those.
Because a reading of the New York law, they have included some misdemeanors, particularly in the area of gambling.
Well, why can't we just leave that so blank for the time being?
Well, it seems to me we've got to until we substantive.
It seems to me. Yeah. Aside from that, does it appear satisfactory?
Yeah, I think we're going to have a real policy decision to make on.
Is there a motion to approve it?
I move we approve it as amended.
Yep. Subject to the completion of sub D and C and sub A.
We're going to have a whole meeting someday just to go back over the things like this that we've left undone. Are we keeping a catalog of them, Don?
Oh, yeah, we have a few dangling things we have to pick up. But this thing, I don't see what we can do other than approve the principle and fill in the crimes later.
Have we taken action on the amended section?
Mm-hmm.
No. We can take them all together then. Mm-hmm. Section 10.
Section 10 is a general section. It limits the party that may apply for these warrants to a district attorney. Mm-hmm. And it limits the period for the warrant to a maximum of 30 days.
There is a provision, though, for...
There are other provisions that if you obtain the information in the warrant earlier, you may have to terminate immediately, or you may have to apply for renewal.
In other words, if the 30-day period produces some but not sufficient information, you can get it renewed upon reapplication.
Yes, you have to, in effect, show all those elements of probable cause that you had to show to obtain the initial order.
And you got to file a transcript of what you've gotten already.
Yes, George.
This is one of the major questions in the entire area, I think, in the 30-day situation. As far as I know, there are no cases which have approved this kind of a dragnet operation. It's really what it is, a real fishing operation that's authorized. I'm hazy on the case involved, but I think it was the Berger case where the wiretap occurred as a result. I'm not sure of the case name. The wiretap occurred as a result of the police being able to specify to the court the exact time when the call was going to be made that they wanted to hear. And they warrant issued for that. I think it was 11 or 12 o'clock at night from a particular place that they knew about, where the call had been made regularly in the past, and they were able to identify this very, very closely. Now, that's an entirely different thing from this kind of provision, which would allow the police to eavesdrop for 30 days on all conversations involving many innocent people as well as people who they suspect. Now, I'm not advocating that you change your mind here, but I think this is one of the very questionable constitutional issues of the law and is not presently authorized by the posture of the United States Supreme Court, and I think that if it fails anywhere, it's going to fail in this area. Now, I would urge, certainly, that this state can of course apply more strict provisions. We can't change it otherwise, but more strict requirements for wiretapping can be added to this bill. And I think this is one place where you ought to think about the stricter provision. Remember, in the search warrant situation, you can't get a search warrant on the basis of searching any home without specificity of what you expect to find. The analogy may not be entirely apt. But there are cases, I can't recall the name of this case either, where the FBI got a search warrant and searched the cabin just inside out for all kinds of items that weren't listed in the search warrant, and the conviction was overturned because so much additional evidence was put in. I think we have the same kind of situation here, where we allow a unsupervised listening in for an extensive time. This can be renewed ad infinitum, I believe, each 30 days. Second question I'd like to ask you, Roger, if the police overhear evidence of other criminal activity, of a misdemeanor type, or something that's not covered by the designated offense, what's the disposition of that?
Well, further sections cover that. They have to reply to a judge then for an amendment to the warrant. In response to your first question, actually, further sections take care of that, and that they require particularity not only as to what you were looking for, in other words, you have to show probable cause that designated offense has been or is about to be committed, what specific person whose conversation you want to overhear, what facilities you want to use, and for what period of time. And if, when you've obtained the information that the warrant authorizes you to obtain, if you want to do any further eavesdropping, you're going to have to go back and get further authorization. So this is just a general statement, and it is modified a great deal.
Under these later provisions, do the police have to indicate the actual time they expect to intercept the conversation?
If possible.
But they don't have to.
No, because
I suppose the point
in many cases, they're not going to be able to do that.
Georgia, Section 2 says right here, no eavesdropping warrant may authorize the interception of any communication for any period longer than is necessary to achieve the objective of the authorization, nor in any event longer than 30 days. So if you have a deal where you're expecting this one telephone call, this one night, and that's all you're going after, your warrant would say, go there and eavesdrop on that line until 2 o'clock tomorrow morning, and then you cut it off and you're through. I mean, there's nothing that limits the authority of the court to say, okay, you've got a warrant to go listen for between the hours of 10 and 2, or listen for the next 2 days only, if that's
it. I wonder why then the general provision is necessary.
Well, it's really to cut it off, make sure it won't go any farther than that, because in the application, we're very specific under Section 12 of the kind of things that have to be alleged in the application for the warrant. And under on page 9, under paragraph E, it includes a statement of the period of time for which the eavesdropping is required to be maintained. And so I think, really, rather than to give the police a carte blanche situation, I think the intent was to make sure that you did have a lid on it, and that in any event, it's not going to go beyond that.
Well, interestingly enough, I checked yesterday on whether under the New York statute there had been any cases yet. I found one case, People versus Botta, came down in September 30, '69. They reversed there, and their eavesdropping warrant only provided it to be effective from June 4th June 21st, 17-day period, and you terminate at such time as conversation sought were recorded. Well, they used their full 17 days, and they obtained a number of incriminating statements, and they found that that went beyond the intent of the order, because they felt the termination was at the pleasure of the police officers, and that they continued to wiretap 2 weeks after they had obtained the incriminating information. They obtained more incriminating information later, but it's that case seemed to indicate that when they first obtained the information they sought, if they felt there was going to be further evidence of criminal conduct, they should have gone back to the judge. And
well, what in this draft would prohibit the police, or would police the police in that kind of situation?
Well, George, the application 12E must state that a statement of the period of time for which the eavesdropping is required to be maintained, and if the nature of the investigation is such that authorization shouldn't automatically end when the communication is provided, then they have to show facts justifying why it's continued, and then the 14 on the warrant. The warrant shall contain the period of time during which the interception is authorized, including the statements of whether the interception shall automatically end when the described communication has been first obtained. So that if you.
Did you have another meeting this week?
I recall a murder case, but I could be mistaken on that. If you say in your warrant, we anticipate that tonight from about 10 o'clock until after midnight, Joe the bookie is going to be taking bets from certain phone booths.
Well,
then presumably the warrant would say, okay, you're authorized to wiretap from 10 tonight until 4 o'clock tomorrow morning, whatever. And unless there were some showing why it should extend further, that'd be it. I agree with you on the policy concern.
I don't want
to tough area.
Prolong this unduly. I sense that I'm alone in my concern, but I don't see that the provision here would restrict the police in the first instance from limiting themselves to the 2 hours. They simply would come before the judge and say, we expect gambling communications in the next 30 days. And for good specific reasons, and who and where and what phones are going to be used, without specifying the time.
But the later,
if that's the type of investigation it is, then it's okay.
Well, that's why I'm saying, I wonder if that's okay.
Yeah,
including sure it is. As to whether the interception shall automatically
looks like a fishing expedition
when the described
investigating. And you've got to have enough information that you're not, that you could convince the judge you're not suspicious.
The form and content of the warrant is specific enough to meet, I believe, the constitutional problem. This is no more than a lid, and I don't believe most of the harder matter is really contained in what your form and content is. It requires a high degree of probable cause to specificity.
Mr. Chairman, as far as the use of these warrants and so on, I think it's so involved that it's going to be a rarity that the police ever go to this trouble, and it'll have to be a very severe kind of thing, like definite organized crime. I don't see them going about using these kind of statutes just generally.
George, it will be recorded that you have made an effort in behalf of the defense. And are there any further discussion?
I just want to get Frank's circulation going this morning.
Anything further on Section 10? Section 11, right here.
Section 11 enumerates the requirements, the grounds on which a warrant can be issued. Sub 1 has to be met, the application has to be in conformity with the article, with the section on what an application requires. And probable cause to believe that a particularly described person is committing or has committed a particularly designated offense, and that would be one of the designated offenses in the earlier section. Probable cause to believe that a particular communication concerning the offense will be obtained. Showing that normal investigative procedures have been tried and failed,
reasonably appear to be unlikely to succeed if tried or too dangerous to employ. And probable cause to believe the facilities which are the place where the communications are to be intercepted are at least two listed in the name of or commonly used by the described person. In other words, all this information is required in the application. And assuming that the judge finds that all these conditions exist, then the warrant would be issued.
Does the word probable cause to believe that particular communications concerning the offense will be obtained, does particular communications mean with respect to the subject matter of the communication, or does it mean the time of the communication?
I think it means the subject matter of a particular communication.
Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Just again, as a matter of semantics, at sub one, is that necessary? Upon an appropriate application made in conformity with this article. I don't particularly like the words appropriate application. I do think that we have to put in something maybe something like upon application showing probable cause to believe that a particular distressed person is set or set. But isn't that upon appropriate application made in conformity with this article?
Because you've got what you're doing here is cranking 12 and 14 and all the other sections into this.
That's what we are.
Well, why don't you take that appropriate?
Yeah.
That seems appropriate. On an application, I mean,
that's appropriate. I guess appropriate is what.
Is there any objection to deleting the word appropriate? Not at all. Be done. Appropriate is stricken.
We're getting a long ways without Chandler today, aren't we?
How would you phrase in Spain? Section 12.
Mr. Chairman, now Section 12 is really the heart of this thing, I think. I think we ought to go through that word for word, really, because it's very explicit under Chapter 119.
All right, will you read it, Roger?
It's very explicit and it's very long.
Read it.
An ex parte application for an eavesdropping warrant shall be made to a judge in writing, shall be subscribed and sworn to by a district attorney. The application shall contain A, the identity of the district attorney and a statement of his authority to make the application. B, a full and complete statement of the facts and circumstances relied upon by the district attorney to justify his belief that an eavesdropping warrant should be issued, including a statement of facts establishing probable cause to believe that a particular designated offense has been, is being, or is about to be committed. A particular description of the nature and location of the facilities from which, or the place where, the communication is to be intercepted. A particular description of the type of the communication sought to be intercepted, and the identity of the person, if known, committing the designated offense, and whose communications are to be intercepted. C, a statement that the communications are not otherwise legally privileged. D, a full and complete statement of facts establishing that normal investigative procedures have been tried and have failed, or reasonably appear to be unlikely to succeed if tried, or to be too dangerous to employ to obtain the evidence sought. E, a statement of the period of time for which the eavesdropping is required to be maintained. If the nature of the investigation is such that the authorization for eavesdropping should not automatically end when the described type of communication has been first obtained, a particular description of facts establishing probable cause to believe that additional communications of the same type will occur thereafter. F, a full and complete statement of the facts concerning all previous applications known to the district attorney for an eavesdropping warrant involving any of the same persons, facilities, or places specified in the application, and the action taken by the judge on each application. sub 3. Allegations of fact in the application may be based either upon the personal knowledge of the district attorney or upon information and belief. If the district attorney personally knows the facts alleged, it must be so stated. If the facts stated in the application are derived in whole or part from the statements of persons other than the district attorney, the sources of the facts must be either disclosed or described, and the application must contain facts establishing the existence and reliability of the informants or the reliability of the information supplied by them. The application must also state, so far as possible, the basis of the informant's knowledge or belief. Affidavits of persons other than the district attorney may be submitted in conjunction with the application if they tend to support any fact or conclusion alleged therein. Accompanying affidavits may be based either on personal knowledge of the affiant or information and belief with the source thereof and the reason therefore specified.
Okay, Chairman Roger, in 3, is this sub 3, is this maintaining the existing law with respect to the identity of confidential informants?
That's what I was just
going to say, either disclosed or described. The sources of the facts must be either disclosed or described. Now, as I understand it, presently, if it's a confidential informant, you don't have to disclose his identity, right? But the way this is worded, it seems to me that you don't have to disclose the source, whoever it is, so long as you describe it. And if that's the case, then it's looser than the existing law. And I wouldn't subscribe to it.
I don't understand your. You say that this would.
It says here that the sources of the facts must be either disclosed or described, right? So, since it's in the disjunctive, all you have to do is describe what the source was without identifying the source, right? Without disclosing it.
But the application must contain facts establishing the existence and reliability of the informants or the reliability of the information supplied by them. Doesn't that take care of you?
I think described in that following sentence doesn't change the existing liability.
You could say, hereby certify and reason to believe the informant is reliable.
Well, but there's a number of arrests.
Right, but
that's describing.
Well,
if we were to eliminate, if we were to delete or describe, then we would be departing from the present law.
Because you'd have to need.
You'd have to disclose.
Well, I think you could very easily solve the problem by a footnote or what we call it.
Commentary
to show that we don't intend to depart from the present case law, that under carefully prescribed circumstances, reliability of confidential informants can be protected, but. Cases are quite clear that where you do seek to preserve the anonymity of the informant, that the affidavit itself must establish facts from which the magistrate can determine the reliability of the information, not the police.
Satisfy you?
Well,
you
perhaps.
Commentary.
First State versus Evans is a kind of a scary case, which just came out about a month ago.
Yeah.
And may not survive review. But
you may misconceive the question that I have, and that is, if the source isn't a confidential informant, then I want the source to be disclosed in the affidavit. You see, I think I do agree that there's a certain public
that's
interest.
Case.
Aren't you talking just about a practical matter, John? That you're trying to build probable cause, and when you've got a named person. You're much better off in going after your
an ordinary citizen. An ordinary citizen came up to me and told me the following. That's all you need, period. You don't have to establish a liability.
Yeah, you can name him.
Right.
So that he is there, and so that whenever you're drawing a search warrant, unless you've got some reason to withhold the name of that informant, you're
going
to
do it.
You're going to name it.
Right, and I want
that. Because
that
helps you in your problem cause.
As a matter of fact, frequently, affidavits to be submitted by the informant where you have no desire to need to protect him.
John, it seems to me that we need this in order to accomplish what you want. We have to have disposed or described here, because in situations where there's a confidential informant, you will describe. In other cases, you will disclose. It's not confidential informant.
But I think the commentary can simply say that we don't intend to change the present case law relating to preserving the anonymity of certain informants.
I do too. Okay. Is it really necessary to go through all this? It's actually in the federal law, just say a full and complete statement of facts and circumstances relied upon by the applicant to justify his belief that an order should be issued, including the details as to the particular offense, human being, and particular description of nature and location of the facilities, etc., and place where to be intercepted, a particular description of the type of communication to be intercepted and the identity of the persons at known committee. I mean, you're going to have sufficient information in your affidavit to establish the probable cause.
Frank, one of the purposes for the specificity here is that this says DA himself has got to do it, and very frequently the DA himself won't have had any personal part in it until it's worked up through his deputies and so on. And
we better clarify that.
Yeah.
Multnomah County would be impossible.
Well,
Mr. Chairman, it's meant, the history of the legislation is it's meant to apply to the district attorney and none of his associates for the purpose of doing the same reason why only a circuit judge can issue this, because it's felt to be such a sensitive area of the law. And this would have the effect that someone suggested earlier of cutting down the number of applications, and that because the DA himself has to take this upon himself to go to the court. And I think that's desirable.
What do you do in a situation where you about 24 hours a day?
They're very kind of
Well, that's true. On the other hand, we are dealing with a sensitive area.
Well, under the extradition situation, the district attorney shall sign, but can he designate to the Secretary of State of certain deputies to sign the extradition?
I'm getting more of a.
But you have a general statute, too, now with respect to deputy district attorneys, don't you? With respect to their authority to act for the district attorney, there's a specific statute in ORS on that.
I can swear that my deputy has all the authority I have other than the right to dismiss himself.
Yeah, and when we were drafting this, now I don't think we had in mind that this had to be limited personally to the district attorney. When we say district attorney, we felt that in Oregon that a deputy district attorney would be authorized to act for the district attorney, he's acting through his authority.
I think it would be practically impossible to limit it to the DA. What do you do in a situation like Multnomah County 8 or 9 years ago when Charlie Raymond is in the hospital for 6 or 8 months and physically isn't able to be there?
George, at the present time, the way of Marine Reserves was perfectly legitimate. He's on vacation, which is legitimate. It was a month out of the year for a season. I think it should be more his
I
assume the court cases specify that for a default you must have the district attorney, and it's always a deputy.
Yeah. Indictments will be signed by the district attorney, they're signed by deputies in 100% of the cases.
As a matter of fact.
Well, I don't think it's a comparable analysis. I think this is an area where the district attorney himself ought to take upon himself the burden of asking for authority to search in an area that is on the very outer limits, I think, of the constitutional idea of search.
What do you do, though, in a place like Los Angeles County, George, where you got 350 deputies and they're in 10 different offices throughout the county?
Well, gosh, I don't know what they do, but we don't have that same problem.
No, but if we have metropolitan government in Multnomah County and Washington, Clackamas, and make the county courthouse in Hillsborough just a town hall.
You're getting close. You're almost there.
I think the question should be cleared up. It should be, or his designated representative, or his deputy. Should be, if there's a serious question, I didn't think there was one. I thought his deputy was implied.
Well, I did too. I didn't think there was any question. In fact, Roger and I talked about putting in deputy district attorney. I said I didn't think it was necessary because the district attorney, his deputy, is authorized in this state act.
There's no reason to believe that a deputy district attorney is going to be less responsible than a district attorney.
Speaking of poll, how many feel that it should the deputy district attorney should have this authority as well as a DA personally? Raise your hand. Somebody make a motion to amend.
Well, I would move that appropriate language be placed in there that well, whether by way of commentary or by way of amendment, provide that this power would extend to deputy district attorneys. Now, if the commission wants certain designated deputies, that's fine, but I think it should.
Now, you're saying deputies only, but not representatives.
No, just deputies only.
Only.
What I had in my question.
Yeah.
Why do we say, or is duly authorized deputy?
I think you're being inconsistent because in that case you ought to extend this authority to district court judges.
Well, because the federal statute says we can't.
Well, okay, but then that states a policy for a very high level operation of
the issuance. Under the federal statute, we can have the police officers coming in and doing this. But under the federal statute, it doesn't have to be the DA.
Well, I'm sure that Mitchell doesn't sign it.
No, I think there was some question. There's no requirement that we have.
I think there was some question in your mind, because the federal statute says the principal prosecuting attorney.
Very often, except in the cases of organized crime. I don't see why this has to be extended broadcast, especially the larger the office.
Though the history is somewhat cloudy, it is my recollection that at least one and possibly two of the United States Attorney Generals have said that they themselves specifically authorized each wiretap, or at least each one that J. Edgar Hoover told them about, or both. In other words, they themselves specifically authorized.
Maybe you're right.
I'm referring to Robert Kennedy and Nick Katzenbach.
They authorized an application under the federal statute. The Attorney General or any Assistant Attorney General, specifically designated by the Attorney General, may authorize an application to the federal judge, but the actual signer can be the FBI agent.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I honestly feel it ought at least to be the district attorney or a deputy of his specifically designated by him to make such applications. Because of the sensitive area involved. In other words, I, with all due respect to the district attorneys, there are, I'm sure that it would be anomalous to find this green deputy down at the police station who's been there 6 weeks charging out for one of these deals, whereas it's a different matter to George specifically designated
through all this and come up with
yeah. Would you
not sure that I can.
In section 12 on page 8, sub 1, I would move to amend, sworn to by a district attorney or by a deputy district attorney specifically authorized by him.
One
Well, the only question I would have is whether under the federal law that that's allowable. They say on page 278, the principal prosecuting attorney of any state or the principal prosecuting attorney of any political subdivision. Now, New York, they don't use the term district attorney, but they use the term applicant. And they say applicant means a district attorney or the attorney general. If a district attorney or the attorney general is actually absent or disabled, the term applicant shall mean that person designated to act for him and perform his official function in and during his actual absence or disability.
That might be bad.
Well, this is why I brought the attention to the commission, the fact that there's policy in the history of the legislation federally and in the states that the authority is not to be broadcast throughout the deputy ranks of the DA. Now, I don't cast any aspersions on deputy DAs. I make the point only that this is historically behind the whole enactment because of the sensitive area.
I cast aspersions.
Roger,
would
you
read
that language again about absence or good cause?
Disability. If, we'll just cut out the attorney general, for example, if a district attorney is actually absent or disabled, then district attorney shall mean that person designated to act for him and perform his official function in and during his actual absence or disability.
Well, why don't we use that? That sounds pretty good to me.
I would so move, Mr. Chairman.
All right, I'll withdraw my previous motion, and I have a note from Mr. Chandler, who read this proposal, and he wants this to apply only to district attorneys in 34 counties. So I want the record to show that we at least brought that up.
Burns motion withdrawn. All those in favor of Don Clark motion will say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed, no. Carried.
Section.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I have a question.
Oh, yeah, one more.
Maybe it's simply a matter of grammar. In 1 sub B, this is on page 8, the application is to describe the offense which has been, is being, or is about to be committed. And then it refers to the identity of the person committing the designated offense. Now, is that inconsistent? The identity of the person committing, which grammatically speaks in terms of a past tense. Now, maybe that's being...
It should be parallel to the previous language.
Well, yeah, it's
right.
It's probably clumsy to make it parallel.
Yeah,
but
it is.
I don't know what to do about it. Maybe we can. I just don't know. What you mean obviously is the identity of the person who has committed or is committing or is about to commit it. And maybe it isn't necessary. I noticed the. I think the language of the federal statute is parallel.
Well, what if we were to say in the identity of known, identity of person if known, and whose communications are to be intercepted, and leave the committing the designated offense, because obviously that relates to the previous.
I suppose maybe committing is broad enough to cover it. Huh? Well, person if known involved in the commission.
Well, this is the federal language. The identity of the person if known committing the offense and whose communications are to be intercepted.
Well, why don't we have a commentary show that there isn't any difference in meaning? Anything further, Mr.
Chairman? I have one other question too. In the same language, here an application requires the identity of the person be listed only if known. In subsection 11, before the warrant can be issued, it requires that the communications be intercepted or the facilities be used are commonly used by the described person. Now, this described person described a particular person if you don't know the person, so you don't put the identity of a person in the application. Is there a described person?
Well, I would say so.
communication or something.
I don't think there's any problem there.
Because under 2, you see sub 2 talks in terms of a particularly described person.
Are you describing by name or the
yeah.
person with the
something
long,
yeah.
dark coat with the mask on his face?
Is there anything further on 12? No, we're going to. Roger, do you care to go to 13 then?
Section 13, method of basis on which the judge to make a determination on the application. For the purpose of determining whether the grounds exist for issuance of the warrant, the judge, if he finds that the application conforms to section 12, may require the district attorney to furnish additional testimony or documentary evidence in support of the application. If the judge determines on the basis of facts submitted by the district attorney that the grounds exist under section 11, he may grant the application and issue the warrant in accordance with section 14. If he finds, the judge does finds that grounds do not exist for the issuance of the warrant, or if the application fails to conform to section 12, he shall deny the application.
Yeah, I think they on that.
Is there a difference?
I thought 12 set out the grounds.
Sub 1 actually means that even though section 12 is fully complied with, the judge may still require the district attorney to furnish additional
yes.
testimony.
Well,
where's George? He would like that.
Just simply says the judge may require the applicant to furnish additional testimony or documentary evidence in support of the application. What do you mean if he finds that we conforms to this, that you would have him...
Well, because under sub 3, if it doesn't conform to section 12, he has to deny it. But if he finds it does conform, he still may want additional information.
Yeah, he can find
what about
it,
the possibility
it conforms, but maybe the grounds don't exist. Because sub 3 speaks in terms of if he finds the ground don't exist, or if the application doesn't conform on either basis, he can deny it.
Yeah, one's really, you're talking about the form of the thing, the other you're talking about what's in it, the substance of it.
Well, I have a question, Mr. Chairman. Furnish additional testimony or documentary evidence. Now, what do we mean by documentary evidence? Do we mean the same sort of material as is described in
yep, at least.
12 sub 3?
Yep. I didn't think there was anybody that had that kind of money.
I would be reluctant to. Well, I think that you'd be in dangerous grounds if you had non-sworn material, either affidavit or...
It's all got to be in writing. From the...
Well,
that's right out of the Federal Act. The judge may require the applicant to furnish additional testimony or documentary evidence in support of the application.
But does it say, does the Federal Act say that even though the judge finds that the application conforms with
no.
what is comparable to Section 12?
No.
So that's where there's a difference.
That's what my question is. What if he finds that it doesn't conform, but if you threw in another affidavit from somebody else that he would find it conformed, and then he would issue it?
I don't believe this prohibits that activity.
Well, it would seem to, because if it doesn't conform, he just denies it. And that means you'd have to come back and file a whole new application and say that we just applied for one 3 hours ago and you denied it. But now we're coming back with this additional. I mean, it doesn't.
It's a practical matter, don't you think?
Why not just use a federal language?
Did you find the tourniquet?
No, you want a copy of that.
Yeah, is it in the
it's book? On page
no,
280.
That's not the latest one.
Section 2. The judge may require the applicant to furnish additional testimony or documentary evidence in support of the application. way it's, it doesn't say whether he feels that there isn't enough or that there is enough but he would like more or what.
You would want to strike if he filed the application for a certain quality, so strike.
Yeah, I don't think it adds anything.
Yes, it does add. It adds considerably.
Now this follows this follows the New York model, and I think the purpose was to set out with more clarity what the judge can do and what the application must contain. It's not as Frank says in chapter 119.
It seems odd to me though, Don, that as we look at this. We see the things that have to be provided, the tests that have to be met, are set forth in section 12. At that point, you would say, all right, if section 12 is complied with, the judge must issue this order. Then we come to 13, and it says that isn't what we mean at all. Because even though the section 12 is fully complied with, the judge may still require more.
Doesn't it give arbitrary discretion to the judge?
No. What it means is, if as a matter of form, 12 is complied with, the judge may ask for more to determine whether the grounds exist. And hence, if he gets more and finds that the grounds exist, then he issues the warrant. But if he finds either initially or upon the additional testimony that the grounds don't exist, or if he finds that it doesn't conform to the form prescribed by 12, then he denies it.
So it isn't referring to substance, but rather to the form.
Initially it refers to form rather than substance.
Well, but there's a lot of substance in section 12.
Yeah, that's what it's doing.
Yeah, at 14. I mean, you're not saying that it conforms to form because there's a whole heck of a lot of stuff in section 12 that has to be there.
Is there a New York commentary?
No.
What does it hurt to go to the federal line? A lot clearer to me.
It seems to me that you might have in this type of a situation a 50-page affidavit, and the judge read it, study it, look it over, and decide, well, if you had this, if you had some information on this point in your affidavit, I would grant the warrant. But the way this is he would have to just simply deny it rather than you coming in and filing a supplemental affidavit to give the probable cause an issue. So you'd have to go back and start all over again.
Full and complete statement.
Well, of course, part of this in 13 is just another way of saying what chapter 119 goes on to say under their subsection 3 on page 280. I mean, the things that the judge has to determine before he issues the warrant, that under A, you know, probable cause for belief about the crime, probable cause communications will be obtained and all this. And we've done that by merely referring back to section 11. Isn't that correct?
All section 13 means that first the judge would examine the application to make certain that it conformed to section 12. In other words, all the necessary allegations were made. But he might not be convinced that some of those allegations would support probable cause. So then he can call for additional testimony to document the evidence. And the basis of that, then...
No, he would simply deny it.
Well, what would happen...
The way you got it, he'd have to just deny it.
What would happen if this were to read in this manner? For the purpose of determining whether grounds exist for the issuance of the warrant, the judge, if he finds that the application formally conforms to section 12 of this article, may.
Why even have that?
Mr. Chairman?
Yeah, it just says it may require the applicant to furnish additional testimony or documentary evidence for the application.
I think the confusion arises from the fact that you refer back to section 12.
I move to strike if he finds that the application conforms to section 12 of this article.
And the comma before the
bid.
The judge may.
The judge may require the district attorney to furnish additional testimony. Is that right?
Mm-hmm.
I second the motion.
One very important.
Is there any discussion?
Question.
All those in favor, do you understand the motion? All in favor say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Carried.
Now, Mr. Chairman, I want to know if you want to also eliminate the reference to section 12 and sub 3.
I would certainly think so.
I so move.
Would that be all if the application fails?
Yes.
If the application doesn't, do we cover it in 12? If the application doesn't conform to 12, must the judge deny it? Without this referral to a second date. What if it doesn't state the period of time that they feel the eavesdropping is required to be made?
Well, isn't that a ground? That would be a ground. That would be a ground condition proceeding to the issuance of the application, which is specified by 12, isn't it? In a matter of substance.
Mr. Chairman, maybe the problem is solved by considering section 14, which specifies what the loan must contain.
Of course, section 14 only applies after the judge has decided the application conforms, and that there are probable grounds. Yes. This is what he has to put, what has to be contained in the warrant.
The identity of the DA is a ground,
if
that's right.
It, in sub 3, it doesn't do the violence that it did up in sub 1, really. And it goes to what Jim said, that 12, section 12, really in a sense, is the matter of form.
I'll withdraw that. I think there's some merit to what you suggest.
We do here in section 3, we do it kind of in the reverse. We say that if he finds that grounds do not exist, he shall deny the application, rather than saying it in a positive fashion like the federal statute does, that if the judge finds that, you know, the proper, the grounds do exist, he may issue. Is there any reason for...
Well, we actually say both, Frank. Under sub 2, we say, and I thought there might be some question brought about about that, where we say he may grant, but then we say he shall deny, and I'm not sure. Now, may is the language, the permissive language that the federal statute uses. But, I mean, if the grounds exist, I don't think that the court's going to have the discretion just to out of hand deny the application. So under 2, you may want to say if the judge determines that the grounds exist, he shall grant the application.
That goes beyond the federal.
Yeah. It occurs to me that I'm not really sure you need sub 3, because if he determines
if he
the fact
grant it, he's going to
exist, why, he may grant it. It's still, there's still some... he's got a part in the decision-making process, and he obviously, if he denies it, he's going to say to himself or say to the DA, well, I don't think you've got adequate grounds. I'm not going to grant it, period.
And as far as if he, as I read the scheme, if he doesn't grant it, why, that's the end of it. You don't appeal or something like that. At least I haven't heard any groundswell from the DA's office that they want to write an appeal on this score.
Well, what other grounds would the judge have to deny it if the application is in proper form and the grounds are there to grant it? Where would the judge be authorized to deny the application? On what basis?
On the basis that he doesn't approve the wiretap.
That can be close.
Or on the basis that he doesn't feel that this situation.
Well, if you say you shall grant it, how are you going to enforce that?
You can still make a ruling that he didn't find adequate grounds.
Yes, I see.
Wait a minute.
They protect themselves pretty easy.
Yeah.
I find that this is just
going to be an adequate
ground. But I'm still
going to grant it. I don't think you're going to find me.
This man David. Well, I don't know if you could, in a situation where a judge who just said in his opinion there were not probable cause was not shown.
Sure.
And even if it
were.
We allow district attorneys certain limited discretion. We should also allow judges to have certain discretion.
Well, then, do you want to take out sub 3?
I don't see where sub 3 does anything, of course. If he finds that cause exists, he may grant the application. Period.
Well,
if you take that out, you better put into sub 2 that it also has to
comply with the form.
The grounds and the field general, would that be right? And the application.
The application should comply
with the form
that exists
right
before you get it.
Okay. Right.
Yeah, if the judge.
Chairman, I move that we amend sub 2 to read. If the judge determines and so forth, the grounds exist under section 11, and that the application conforms to section 12, he may grant the application and so on, and further to delete sub 3.
You've heard the motion. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Carry.
I move we approve 13 as amended.
We're going to approve them all. We haven't been sure of the others. That's the way.
Trying to get them in the
Oh. Put his name in the text. Section 14.
How many have you had to call you?
Section 14 laid out the form and content required of the warrant issued by the judge.
What she means.
Well, I made me get
shall contain the name of the applicant, date of issuance, description and title of the issuing judge, the identity of the person if known whose communications are to be intercepted, the nature and location of the communication facilities or the place where the interception is going to be made, a particular description of the type of communication sought to be intercepted, a statement of the particular designated offense to which it relates, the identity of the law enforcement agency authorized to intercept communications, the period of time for which the interception is authorized, including a statement as to whether the interception shall automatically end when the described communication has been first obtained, provision that the authorization to intercept shall be executed as soon as practicable, shall be conducted in a way that will minimize the interception of communications not otherwise subject to eavesdropping, shall terminate upon attainment of the authorized objective, or in any event in 30 days, and an express authorization to make secret entry upon a private place or premises to install the eavesdropping device.
Chairman, really we're talking about, this parallel to section 12. I wonder about this problem. Let's say you have suppose you have a kidnapping case, and the police are starting to get somewhere in their investigation, and they want to wiretap my phone because they are able to show that there's reason to believe that I'm going to be making ransom calls
to the victim. And let us say further, they say, well, we know he's going to be home this evening, and we expect these calls to take place from 10 o'clock this evening until noon tomorrow, or something like that. So, is it the intention here that they have to stop when I make the first ransom call, or that they can go ahead and record a dozen ransom calls, or what? What is the theory here? I'm not sure I really know.
You mean in six?
In six, and the comparable language in section 12, sub E, 2 sub E.
You answer that, Roger.
Well, for example, of course, that question really involves a number of things, because first you're showing the identity of the person, John Doe kidnapper, location of what you want to tap, a particular phone, relates to kidnapping, the police are going to do the actual tapping. Now, the period of time during which the interception is authorized would relate also to four, a particular description of the type of communications sought to be intercepted, communications in the plural. Well, communications might involve a series of negotiations on kidnapping. In other words, you might want a 72-hour wiretap for longer if you could convince the judge that these negotiations are going to continue over a period of time, including a statement as to whether the interception shall automatically end when the described communication, well, the described communication may not be a single communication, it may be a series of communications.
Should we make that plural?
As far as statutory construction is concerned, the singular means plural anyway.
Well,
what it says is that it has to be passed automatically, it has to specify it.
Well, in other words, what is the warrant going to say? That the interception shall automatically end when the first six ransom calls have been made?
The hope is dependent upon what designated crime we're talking
about. Well, if you look back at section 12 on the application under paragraph E, you're going to have to submit a statement of the time, period of time for which the eavesdropping is required to be maintained. And if the nature of the investigation is such, which in a kidnapping negotiation probably would be, that authorization for eavesdropping should not automatically end when the described type of communication has been first obtained. For some of these questions as to procedure are really present time unanswerable, because this is new law and it really hasn't been tested. No cases.
Chairman, I apologize for raising the question.
There's
no answer. Or it's already been resolved.
Your apology will be duly noted.
You have subsection 1. 7 and 8 are in addition to what's required under the federal law, aren't they?
Oh, the name of the applicant is always on it.
Well, I think it would be implied in the name of the judge, except that under the federal law, it doesn't. It's just each order authorizing or approving the interception of any wire or oral communication shall specify, then sets out what we have as 2, 3, 4, 5, and 6. Although I would think that 1 would probably be implied. I mean, the signature of the judge has certainly got to be there somewhere in this type of files.
But you don't have any serious objection to leaving 1, do you?
No, not to.
Are you leaving the witness?
The 7 and 8, where did those come from and why?
Well, some of this language is based upon what New York, for example, and the United States Congress felt was the feeling of the United States Supreme Court, as indicated, say, by the Berger and the Katz cases. and they are using perhaps more language than is required specifically, for example, in the federal law. But what they're trying to do is minimize any danger that when these laws are reviewed by the Supreme Court, that they feel that they're overly broad. And that language, for example, shall be conducted in a way that will minimize the interception of communications, not otherwise.
The whole commission is going to
lunch. That is a statement, in effect, taken out of the Katz case.
What they all put down
the Supreme Court felt that that's one of the considerations of this type of legislation to take into account. Because they were concerned about the effect of a general warrant.
Yeah, that's what Hubbard told me.
All available. I'm trying to say they would have said they want.
Yeah.
Frank, you've had your way quite a little bit this morning. Are you?
Well, I'm not really. I was just curious, you see.
Oh.
Chairman, may I ask a question?
Yes, George.
Subparagraph 8 is contained in the New York Act, Roger, you said. Is there anything comparable in the federal act? I understand there isn't. Is that correct?
No,
there
isn't.
Well, I guess an interesting situation. In other words, a court is allowing a trespass. Is that correct? Criminal trespass is being authorized by the court, presumably into a private home. I think it's an extension far beyond.
But they don't, presumably under the federal act, they can do it without an express authorization by the judge. Is that right?
I would presume so, because in many cases it's here, they're going to be able to execute the warrant.
Yeah, how are you going to execute if you can't get in there to put your device?
On a pattern of Katzenberger, there were no trespasses involved. And you're now authorizing something beyond those cases.
Well, isn't there really a trespass involved in issuance of the warrant where this language isn't present in the law and they're authorized to install the eavesdropping device?
Of course.
You certainly wouldn't go to the fellow who owned the home, whose word you wanted to obtain, and say, may I have your consent? Because I have a warrant here, I don't want you to know anything about.
That's true, but Judge, aren't you guilty of aiding and abetting criminal trespass if you authorize that?
Sure, but the whole point of Katz was to get away from the artificial distinction of common law trespass in the Silverman case, and that's why they said, in both Katzenberger, that you can do this. As a matter of fact, they specifically said in Katz, or in amendment, that if it were done with adequate judicial safeguards, you could do that sort of thing. And you get away from the question about what is or is not a technical common law trespass. If you're invading the guy's privacy enough to overhear and record his conversation, what difference does it make if you go on the premises to clip the thing on the phone or something?
Well, then, isn't it just one step further to installing a policeman in the closet? I object strenuously to this kind of a provision. There are ways to wiretap and eavesdrop without physical intrusion into a private home or private business office. There are very effective ways to do it.
Well,
and I would hate to see our court system get involved in authorizing criminal trespass.
Well, it seems to me.
But this would only apply where such injury
the police.
Was necessary in order to execute it. If the physical injury wasn't necessary, if the mechanical or electronic devices were available, and the phone was so situated that you don't need to make the entry, you don't make it.
Yep. In fact, you can't make it unless the court specifically authorizes under sub 8.
George, it seems to me that by very virtue of the fact that we have this provision, it puts some restraint on police activity, and that part of the judge's responsibility in granting this.
It might make it more visible, but it certainly doesn't put any restraint on it.
Well, I think it does.
I detect another law review article.
You know, George,
the record, Mr. Chairman.
George, I had the feeling the last meeting that you were having too good a day.
You know, I have a question.
What's the general feeling with reference to 7 and 8?
I think you're all prosecution.
Go the other way. Keep three guys lined up. I think
Is there any further discussion on 14?
I just have one question quickly, because I know we all want to adjourn tomorrow. Does this eavesdropping warrant go on file in the clerk's office? I'm representing the Marcus Stark Street, and I have reason to believe that Tom O'Dell is investigating me and has got an eavesdropping warrant, and I want to know. So I go up to the county clerk's office, or send my lawyer up there, or somebody, to try to find out. Now, I know what you do with search warrants. They're on their way to be filed in the clerk's office, but somehow or other they never get there.
Well, eventually after the case.
Yeah, right. Now,
yeah, we say what's done with these things by the court. You should read this stuff before we meet.
Section 19.
Well, I was reading the federal act.
Oh. I got the mark about
it. You got a little help from me in that case.
That's true. Thank you.
Does that answer your question?
Yes.
For the time being?
Yes.
Yes. Lest we forget, does somebody wish to move that we approve as amended sections 2 through 14.
I will so move.
You've heard the motion. Any further discussion? Call the roll.
Judge Burns.
Aye.
Sanderson.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Clark.
Aye.
Straw.
Aye.
Paz.
Aye.
O'Dell.
Aye.
Nye.
Aye.
Young.
Aye.
Mr. Chairman.
Aye. Carried. Does 1:30 sound like a good
time
for news break?
Roger.